Hi everyone and welcome to A to Easy. Today our episode is on stroke, so we're going to be looking at the definition of stroke, pathophysiology and some key aspects of presentation, investigation and management. But first, welcome to my special guest.
Special guest, I'm here most times. It's Harry. Hey everybody.
Hi Harry, nice to have you on with us. Let's get going. So Harry, what do you think a stroke is?
I think it's a neurological deficit that lasts more than 24 hours.
Nice. Someone's been learning their year two neurology. And like, that is technically correct, but we're going to break it down a little bit more because we're in hospitals now. Like, there's other things we need to consider. Firstly, that neurological deficit, I want you to remember that it's focal. So remember the phrase focal neurology. For example, the patient's face might have drooped. They might not be able to move an arm or a leg, but something you can specify has gone wrong. And this tells us that a specific part of the brain has been affected. The opposite would be something like encephalitis, where general inflammation causes a patient to be generally unwell with confusion, temperature, etc., etc. And then going back to the definition, it's true that you will often see the 24-hour rule in textbooks, and as I said, it is technically correct. That focal neurological deficit, if left untreated, will last more than 24 hours. It will be irreversible. However, that's more of a research definition because in clinical practice, if a patient comes in with symptoms of stroke, please do not wait 24 hours before you treat them. It's a medical emergency. Time is brain.
So the neurological deficit would last more than 24 hours if there was no intervention. But of course, we aim to actually treat strokes as fast as possible. But isn't there like another version of a stroke that doesn't last very long?
Yes.
Hint.
Yes, in a way. You can get these things called TIAs, which you might have heard of. Harry obviously has. Well done. They're called transient ischemic attacks. Again, technically, you could say that these result in focal neurological deficits that last less than 24 hours, and that's what differentiates them from stroke in clinical practice. However, in reality, TIAs, the symptoms resolve within minutes, probably before the patient even gets to the hospital.
Okay.
The pathophysiology of TIA and stroke are very similar, which we'll talk about in a moment, but the main message is don't wait 24 hours to work out if it's a stroke or a TIA. If it's a TIA, the symptoms will resolve very rapidly, and in a stroke, you just cannot afford to wait around. You'll never walk into an ED and find people hanging around waiting to find out if it's a stroke or whether it's going to sort itself out. That's not really how we work. But actually, like, we're jumping ahead. Let's talk about what actually causes the strokes and TIAs as well. So, Harry, picture a brain.
Okay. This is a podcast. It's not visual.
True. Don't worry, everybody. I'm going to signpost you to some useful links when they're needed. But for now, everybody, picture a brain in your head, if that makes sense. Now imagine that brain is woven through with a network of tubes, so like water pipes in a building, and these are our cerebral arteries, which you will probably know all the names of from year two neurology.
Of course.
There are two things that can go wrong, and they result in either an ischemic or a hemorrhagic stroke. They both can look the same in the patient, but it is important to know that the pathophysiology can be different because of the way we treat, but we'll talk about that in a moment. What you guys need to remember is that 80% of strokes are actually ischemic, 20% are hemorrhagic. So if you're on the ward round and a consultant asks you what type of stroke they had, if you didn't read the ward round notes or you weren't listening,
play the odds.
Exactly, and go for ischemic. Thinking about what's actually happened, in an ischemic stroke, it means that something has got stuck in one of those pipes. It's got stuck in an artery. So this could be a thrombus that's formed in the vessel itself, or it could be an emboli that's thrown off by the heart in a dodgy rhythm. Though the point is the artery is blocked, so there's no blood supply to the surrounding brain tissue. Brain dies. And now we come to the TIAs.
So those are like your mini strokes, ischemic strokes, right?
Yeah, you often hear patients call them like mini strokes. It's quite a common phrase that's thrown around. I would say it's more like a practice run of a stroke because there was a blockage, a clot of some kind, but basically it just didn't get stuck long enough to cause the irreversible damage. And that's why the neurological deficits recover really quickly. As you said, even perhaps before the patient makes it to A&E, they're in the ambulance, actually the patient's symptoms resolve. Mm-hmm. However, they are still really important to pick up and shouldn't really be called a mini stroke because they show that a big stroke, proper stroke if you like, is on its way. In fact, I think the stat is that a third of people with TIA will have a full-blown stroke in the next 5 years.
Okay, so you want to prevent that, so it's time for some good old preventative medicine.
Well done, Harry. Someone's been doing his public health modules. But yeah, exactly. The risk is that patients who've had TIAs before, or think of them as mini strokes, know that they get better and don't seek treatment or help. And that's really bad because, as you say, there's a big risk that they'll have a stroke in the future, and that risk is highest in the first 24 to 72 hours after they've had the TIA. So if someone's had a TIA, what needs to happen is they need to be seen in a rapid access TIA clinic within the next 24 hours. That's where the patient's true risk can be assessed and all of that lovely preventative medicine can be decided. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so.
Meanwhile, that second type of stroke is a hemorrhagic stroke, and hemorrhage just means that the artery is leaking, the pipe has burst. Any ideas what might cause that, Harry?
So if you've got an increased pressure in the pipe, that can cause a pipe to burst. So hypertension.
Nice. Yes, hypertension. Excess strain, excess pressure on the blood vessels, on the pipes day after day, eventually one ruptures. This is specifically called an intracerebral hemorrhage. It's all in the name. And as we said, you can't usually tell the difference between an ischemic stroke and a hemorrhagic stroke on clinical presentation. And in many ways, the pathophysiology is the same, because the rupture just means that the local brain is still deprived of that blood supply. Brain dies. However, one thing to note is that with a hemorrhagic stroke, if it is a really big bleed, a really major hemorrhage, you can get a more generalised picture, because the force at which the blood is leaking through the ruptured vessel puts pressure on the surrounding tissues. Your cranium is like a closed box, right?
Mm-hmm.
As blood is gushing out one of those vessels in that closed box, it builds up pressure, and that pressure can't go anywhere, so it starts to compress the surrounding tissues. And this is called mass effect.
Oh, that does not sound good.
No, it's definitely not good, because it's two massive problems, isn't it? It's the same as an ischemic stroke, in that you have some local brain tissue being deprived of blood supply, but the rest of the brain is getting squashed by this huge high-pressure wave of blood that's stuck inside the cranium. And it does mean that sometimes hemorrhagic strokes can present unusually with things like loss of consciousness or headache, rather than what we'd say is like a classic picture stroke.
Okay, so let's take this and move on to presentation. So you've said so far that there's a very large hemorrhage, and it can cause this mass effect, which is massively bad, and it gives a more generalized neurological pathology. That's the exception, right? A special case. But how do strokes usually present, whether ischemic or intracerebral hemorrhage?
Good question. So presentation is difficult to describe fully, let alone in the podcast, because it obviously depends on where the stroke is in the brain, what part of the brain is deprived of the blood supply, therefore what part of the brain gives cause to that focal neurology that we talked about.
Okay.
Thankfully, some very clever people in the past have come up with a classification system for stroke that helps us localize this.
Yay, we love classifications.
We sure do. So this one is called the Oxford or Bamford classification, and it's one that you'll see used clinically. It's a little bit confusing, because often in years 1 and 2, we learn strokes by which artery has been blocked. So we might learn a stroke looks like this if an anterior cerebral artery has been blocked, mm-hmm. middle cerebral artery, or posterior, right?
Yep.
So that's useful when we're learning about anatomy, but not so useful once we get into the clinical setting. On the wards, everyone's using the Oxford Bamford classification.
Okay. So what's that?
Okay. So the Oxford Bamford classification puts strokes into 3 categories, again relating to where in the brain which arteries have gone wrong. Are you ready?
I'm so ready.
Amazing. Number 1, anterior circulation strokes include strokes of the anterior cerebral artery or the middle cerebral artery. Anterior circulation strokes are the most common type. So if you're going to remember one, remember that one. And within that, the middle cerebral artery is more likely to be the cause than the anterior cerebral artery. M for most common, okay?
Yes.
These are massive vessels. So with anterior circulation strokes, you get big deficits. Usually 1 of 3 things, so another list of 3. Unilateral weakness, problems with speech, or a homonymous hemianopia, okay?
Okay, so an anterior circulatory stroke causes unilateral limb weakness and homonymous hemianopia, and that's on the opposite side to the stroke in terms of presentation.
Yes, exactly, because again, if we remember our second year neuro, there's decussation of the pyramids in the spinal cord. If the stroke is on the right side of the brain, you'll have left-sided limb weakness, and you'll lose the left visual field in both eyes.
Okay.
Okay. To give a little bit more detail on both of those, when we think about this unilateral weakness, we can now think back to year 2 and picture the homunculus, mm-hmm. which shows us the territories of both the anterior cerebral artery and the middle cerebral artery. There's a link to this image, guys, in the notes, so have a look if you have data in the moment. Anterocerebral artery strokes, you'll remember that that's like the medial part of both hemispheres. So you're more likely to get weakness in the leg with an anterocerebral artery stroke and in the arm in a middle cerebral artery stroke. But overall, for anterior circulation strokes, which involve both vessels, you'll get unilateral weakness. That's the main thing to remember. Does that make sense?
Yep. So when we're talking about these presentations, we often tell patients to think fast. That's this kind of picture, right?
Yeah, exactly. FAST is like building public health awareness of what stroke is, because as we've said, ischemic is the most common cause of stroke. Anterior circulation strokes are the most common cause of ischemic strokes. And within that, the middle cerebral artery is the most common cause of anterior circulation strokes. And as we said, middle cerebral artery strokes are the most common cause of anterior circulation strokes.
Yep.
And if we put all of that together, we'll see that we will get face drooping, which is the F. We will get arm weakness, which is the A. We will get speech deficits, which is the S. And T is for time, because time is brain, as we've said all along.
Okay. So your most common, think fast, that's the one that everyone's told to think about, therefore it's the one that's most common. That's your middle cerebral artery, most likely, as part of your anterior circulatory stroke.
Exactly. And that's the one you're going to see described in your exam questions, guys. Today, we are just going to focus on anterior circulation strokes because they are the most common in real life and in exams, but we will cover posterior circulation strokes and lacunar ones in a future episode, guys, so don't worry.
So alongside the brisk reflexes, would you also see increased tone?
Well, it's possible, but actually, this is a chronic sign of stroke. It wouldn't be something you'd see on an acute presentation. If the patient has increased tone, shows that they might have had a stroke weeks to months ago. That doesn't also mean they're not having a stroke right now, but remember that increased tone is a chronic sign, brisk reflexes is acute.
Oh, okay. Anything else we may pick up on upper and lower limb exam?
There may be a sensory change on the affected side. The main thing to remember is that it won't be well defined. It won't be dermatonal, it won't be glove and stocking, because the problem is in the brain and not in the lower major neurons. The other two symptom signs were with vision and speech, right? Both of these will be elicited on a cranial nerve exam. With speech, it's important to work out if the patient has dysarthria or dysphasia.
Okay, and what is the difference between those two?
Okay, well, dysarthria means difficulty in articulation. The muscles of the face aren't working well together to produce speech. Dysphasia means that there's a problem with the processing of speech, and that's that higher cortical processing function we said at the beginning was one of the three cornerstones of an anterior circulation stroke. However, sorry Harry, but there are two types of dysphasia which we do need to know about. So, it's really important to know what these two types of dysphasia are and be able to diagnose them properly, because again, they're quite easy to miss, especially if there's a language barrier, the patient might have a pre-existing speech difficulty, or the patient is confused and is finding it difficult to find the right words anyway. So the first type is called expressive dysphasia, and this means that the patient can understand what you're saying but cannot form the words to reply to you. For the keen beans, it means that the Broca's area in the frontal cortex has been affected. The other type is called receptive dysphagia, and it's in the name. It means that the patient can't understand what is being said, so their answer will have no relevance to what you've asked them and may not make any sense at all, but it will be fluent. They won't have a problem coming up with the words. And again, for the keen beans, this is Wernicke's area in the temporal lobe that's been affected.
So firstly, you've got dysarthria, which is disarticulation, essentially, and then you have dysphagia, which is in two types. You've got expressive dysphagia, which means they can't get the words out at all. And then there's receptive dysphagia, where they might not make any sense at all and they'll just say random words, but the words come out okay.
Yes, exactly. If it's helpful for people, I remembered that Wernicke's area was receptive because U for understanding and W are close to each other in the alphabet.
That is so terrible. That is terrible.
I'm trying to share all my tips and tricks, but my tips and tricks are really bad. So that's how I remember it. Okay, back to the patient. So you've got your patient in A&E, you've taken the history, you've asked the relative or the partner the history, you've examined them, and you are pretty sure that it's a stroke. Now, there are bedside tests we can do, and we always should do them, and definitely say, there are bedside tests that you definitely should do. For example, a full blood count with CRP and lactate, which could help you differentiate between an unusual presentation of meningitis. I'd also include a clotting screen in that to see if the patient's on blood thinners, which may indicate which pathophysiology of stroke. General biochemistry and blood glucose, also very important. But I would say there is one key investigation for stroke that you should never, ever forget.
A head CT.
Yes, Harry. Well done. We need to see what's going on. We need to see, number one, where in the brain is affected by the stroke. But two, back to our first point, is this an ischemic stroke or is this hemorrhagic? And why is that important?
Treatment?
Yes. Nice. Because if this is a blockage, a clot, an ischemic stroke, we need to thrombolyse it. So the mainstay of treatment for an ischemic stroke is thrombolysis, usually using something called Ultraplase, and you want to do this less than 4.5 hours from the onset of symptoms. Again, why the history is so important. Meanwhile, a TIA, the practice run, you may just use aspirin in the short term. And then, do you remember what we do next with TIA patients, Harry?
Refer to the rapid access clinic.
Nice. Yes, exactly. We definitely wouldn't want to do either of these things for a hemorrhagic stroke because both aspirin and Ultraplase, in simple terms, thin the blood. This would increase the bleeding, increasing the likelihood of mass effect, and altogether just be an absolutely terrible idea.
So essentially, from an F1 point of view, you will order the head CT and then you will call the stroke team.
No, call the stroke team first. I know this may seem illogical because you might be like, oh, I haven't confirmed the diagnosis, I need the head CT. But time is brain and you should always call the stroke team first, especially if you're not in a stroke centre. If it's a stroke syndrome clinically and they're presenting early, they need immediately blue light transfer to the stroke centre, not to wait for a CT scan where they are, and fast, because time is brain.
Okay, so time is brain. Does that mean that's it and we're done?
Not quite. You've called the stroke team. Hopefully they've been blue lighted to a stroke centre or the stroke team in your centre is looking after them well. We also need to make sure that the patient's been screened for the risk factors that could have caused the stroke in the first place. Any idea what they might be?
So, I mean, we mentioned hypertension before.
Yes, that's a major one for both ischemic and hemorrhagic, so really important to remember.
And atrial fibrillation?
Yep, exactly. That can throw off one of those clots that can cause an ischemic stroke.
And finally, keeping with that, to round it out, atherosclerosis.
Excellent. Yeah, so the thrombus could have come from within the vessel itself, which means atherosclerosis. It's also a major risk factor. So in terms of follow-up for stroke patients, we're going to need an ECG, maybe an echo, some carotid imaging, and a major review of the current medications of the patient. And that is it.
Okay. All right.
Hey everyone, it's Yvonne here with your 30-second summary. Strokes can be classified as ischemic or hemorrhagic. Ischemic are much more common. You can also use the Oxford-Bamford system to classify strokes. Anterior circulation strokes involving the middle cerebral artery result in the classic picture of stroke, as remembered by the mnemonic FAST. In the history, you need to determine symptom onset, and in the examination, look for unilateral weakness and brisk reflexes on the contralateral side. A head CT is needed to determine whether the stroke is ischemic or hemorrhagic, which guides the treatment. Treatment for an ischemic stroke usually involves thrombolysis. Ideally, it needs to happen with 4.5 hours of symptom onset. Thanks for listening.